Alright, I'll try not to. The Senate's Public Safety and Budget Division will come to order. Today is Valentine's Day, 2007. We have two items on the agenda today. We're going to hear from the Gang and Drug Task Force on their activities and their budget. And then we're going to hear from the Financial Crimes Task Force on their activities and their budget. Why don't we get started right away with the Gang and Drug Task Force? Whenever you're ready, just go ahead and start, please. We have information in your folder, members, in the Today folder. Looks like maybe the same presentation that you'll see up on the screen.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Wade Setter. I'm the police chief in Brooklyn Park, and I currently chair the Minnesota Gang and Drug Oversight Council, and we're here today to discuss some of our accomplishments and background over the past 2 years, and you do have the same presentation in your packets. First of all, historically, we started with the narcotics task forces that were funded since 1998 by the Department of Public Safety through Byrd Memorial Grant funding, which is pass-through funding from the federal government. At that time, the commissioner's office established a narcotics enforcement coordinating committee that was consisted of public safety, criminal justice professionals from throughout the state of Minnesota to advise the commissioner on the distribution of those grant funds to the drug task forces. As you may recall, the Minnesota Gang Strike Force was created by special legislation in 1997, and that legislation also created the Criminal Gang Oversight Council. The state was divided into six regions with approximately 70 total officers, and there was funding for those officers through the state appropriations. However, as time progressed, as recently as 2004, state funding was diminished, and the Strike Force operated with about a total of 30 officers assigned, approximately half of those in the metropolitan area. 2005, there was legislation introduced that created the Minnesota Gang and Drug Oversight Council with the goal of improving coordination of efforts throughout the state. This new council replaced the pre-existing Narcotics Enforcement Coordinating Committee and the Criminal Gang Oversight Council. The responsibilities of the Oversight Council included establishing a Metropolitan Gang Strike Force and other multi-jurisdictional task forces throughout the state. We were commissioned with selecting a statewide coordinator, assist in developing a process for awarding grants through the Department of Public Safety, and also to adopt criteria and identifying characteristics to determine the criminal gang membership, who is in a gang in the state. And finally, and probably foremost from the operations side, was assist in developing an information sharing system along with an operating budget. Since that legislation, 2005, we were able to accomplish many of these objectives. First of all, we established task force eligibility requirements, which were consistent with what we used historically in many ways. We had to look at local needs and establish the goals and objectives related to those needs. All of our task forces work under the direction of a local advisory board, so the local control component was very important. We wanted to coordinate efforts, which is the overbearing emphasis, and yet maintain a statewide focus, so we would have interjurisdictional cooperation. Participate and establish information sharing systems, and then also operate in conformance with our professional standards that were developed by the council. A lot of local resources go into this far and above both the federal and state funding. In 2006, we awarded 32 grants to task forces throughout the state of Minnesota. The grant funds really support about approximately one-third of local agency participation. For example, in Brooklyn Park, we participate in the Hennepin-Anoka Drug Task Force, and in that particular organization, we have 14 investigators from 8 agencies. We receive about $200,000 in burn funding. However, we are responsible at the local level for all of the wages for those officers at about $80,000 apiece. That dollar amount is significant. It comes out to about 30%. Other task forces funded in 2006 included the recreation of the Metro Gang Strike Force and 20 other drug task forces around the state, 9 of which have gang officer components. Some of the accomplishments just in 2006, and my understanding is the data is just finally being fully compiled, but over 5,000 arrests, 89% of which are at a felony level, and that's significant. Methamphetamine, which I know the legislature has seen and heard a lot of information about over the last couple of years, accounted for 43% of the arrests. As recently as 2 years ago, that number was as high as 50%. Marijuana is still a significant problem, and cocaine is growing. 156 gang-related arrests, 381 gang net entries. That's the intelligence component of our gang system throughout the state. And as you can see, the labs and firearms seized. One thing I would not want to, I would be remiss in not mentioning is the educational component. Many of our gang and narcotics investigators throughout the state of Minnesota do a lot in educating the public, not only at the school level for our students and young people, but at the community level at virtually in virtually every community throughout the state. Metro Gang Strike Force this past year had 32 Metro investigators, which is up from approximately 14 prior to the 2006 funding year. So we did broaden our scope of participation and almost tripled the number of investigators assigned. Last year, they accomplished 509 arrests, 238 search warrants, and a lot of our gang-related investigations do have a crossover into the narcotics investigation, which is another I think significant reason for collaboration and communication between both drug and gang investigators. And also gang education is a consistent ongoing need. One of the big changes for us with the last year was the assignment and identification of a statewide coordinator that's selected to facilitate and monitor these efforts. Certainly the Oversight Council consists of approximately 32 members of the law enforcement and criminal justice community in Minnesota. None of us are full-time, and this is really the one full-time employee that we have to go out and ensure that the policies and procedures we establish are there, also to provide technical assistance and to monitor and ensure that our task forces are performing as they say they're going to perform in our grant applications. Bob Bushman happens to be our statewide coordinator at this particular point in time, and I know that Mr. Bushman has spent last year and has personally met with every single task force advisory board in the state of Minnesota, which is a significant accomplishment. We're still working on the information sharing component, and that is not a small task in Minnesota with some of the constrictions contained within the Minnesota Data Practices Act. We are working on that, and we are making improvements. Our biggest goal is to reduce the opportunity for investigators. It's called deconfliction, where investigators, if they're conducting investigations from two separate task forces, for example, we want to ensure that no officer safety issues are compromised if they should make an arrest at the same time or something like that. So that is probably the biggest safety issue for us. One of the things that was I think we're most proud of is developing a statewide strategy. That was one of the legislative charges in 2005. And in order to do that, we felt it was important to receive testimony and have discussion with our shareholders throughout the state. We had presentations by 21 gang and drug task forces throughout Minnesota, and we convened regional meetings in Minneapolis, Owatonna, and Bemidji, not only with the law enforcement partners, but with other criminal justice partners, and including local elected officials. Once we did that over the course of last summer, we concluded with a facilitated planning session to develop this strategy. The key elements that came out of that planning process is that we are committed to fighting drug and gang crime through multi-jurisdictional task forces. The Oversight Council firmly believes that interagency cooperation and collaboration is the key to our success and our future, and multi-jurisdictional task forces achieve that. We are still committed to working through the information sharing process, and in this year we'll be expanding that at least with a deconfliction system that will help facilitate officer safety needs of the investigators working in this, and longer term establishing some sort of information sharing system for all gang and drug investigations we know is a critical component and is a high priority for us as we move forward. I think we all have concerns about limited financial resources for the gang and drug and task forces throughout Minnesota, and we want to ensure that they are held accountable to not only professional standards, but produce meaningful results. And that is one of the charges that our Our coordinator is responsible for is to bring that data back to us, but certainly we do monitor all of their performance data, and as we go through the application and grant process, we're able to look and see which task forces perhaps need technical assistance or need to have other assistance in order to improve their outcomes. The Oversight Council feels very strongly that the law enforcement component of this that we focus on through this initiative is certainly an ends, or certainly a means, but is not an ends. And education and prevention, treatment are all components of this in solving the longer-term problem for both drug addiction, drug abuse, and gang membership issues in our society. Even though we're not actively involved in that, we do work closely with Carol Falkowski, who is one of our public representatives. She is a treatment coordinator from Hazelden Foundation, used to work for the Department of Health of Minnesota, and monitors drug abuse trends throughout the state, and has provided presentations to us as recently as last month to help educate us with what the current drug trends are. As we move forward into 2007, federal funding historically has been about $2.75 million a year through the BURN program to support the narcotics enforcement. The majority of that money does go to the drug task forces, and that is typically operational support. As I alluded before, local agencies that participate in the drug task forces are responsible for the wages and most of the overtime for the investigators they assign to the multi-jurisdictional effort. It does provide about 30% of the overall cost of operating when personnel costs are considered. For fiscal year 2007, at the congressional level in Congress, we're not sure where we're going with regard to funding, that $2.75 million. They have no funding allocated for 71107, and the President's budget for fiscal year 08 does eliminate the Burn Justice grant funding, although we're hopeful that some of that money will pass through, and that's our latest information. The state funding on this side of the table in supporting task force operation has been historically primarily targeted to gang enforcement. The budget is $3.82 million for state fiscal year 07, and grants totaling about approximately $3 million of that for salary support for 56 gang officers and 11 drug investigators throughout the state. The Metro Gang Strike Force has operational support of approximately $0.4 million. And there's statewide support of $0.35 million for oversight training, and it's the administrative costs that are incurred by the Department of Public Safety for managing these operations. For 2007, our task forces, we've awarded 36 grants, 24 total task forces throughout the state of Minnesota, 22 drug task forces, 11 with gang officer complements, the Metro Gang Strike Force, and most recently the formation of the St. Cloud Metro Gang Strike Force, which was part of the legislative initiative last year. Some of the goals for our statewide coordinator for this year is getting back to that accountability component, evaluate the performance of the task forces, also to provide training for use of this deconfliction information sharing system. We want to ensure our task forces adhere to professional standards and best practices. And last year, we convened a subcommittee to develop a operating procedural manual that would help task forces perform at that level. And it is by grant application requirements has to be adopted by each of the task forces. The statewide coordinator also meet quarterly reports to the Council on Task Force Operations and these measurable results. Part of our statewide strategy and council goals is looking at a long-term funding strategy. One of the things I've been involved with the narcotics component of this through the NEC committee since about 1988. I'm a former drug task force commander, and the burn money has been kind of an up and down thing for us consistently. We started out 15 years ago with about the state received about $8 million from the federal government. That is now reduced to about, I think it's around $3 million that we get, and it's been a substantial reduction. Every year we are struggling with whether or not the funding is going to be there to continue these task force operations. So our funding strategy is, I think, one of our key objectives that we need to move forward on. We need to increase this coordination and sharing of information. It's absolutely critical not only for officer safety but for the efficiency of these investigations. To have redundant investigative efforts on common criminal targets just does not make a lot of sense. It's not an efficient way of doing business. And we need to continue the development of evaluation and accountability. Things change. just the transition from in methamphetamine 5 years ago and the development of the occurrence of a large number of meth labs now to very few meth labs and a shift back towards cocaine are all the types of things that we constantly have to be looking at. And with that, Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm looking at the back side of this very colorful map of the state. And you lay out the federal funds and the state funds. Are there not local funds in here as well?
Madam Chair, the local funds are not shown in there, and a lot of that has to do with the state reporting, state and federal reporting requirements. For example, I can share Brooklyn Park and the Anoka Hennepin Drug Task Force, which is at the top. We receive about $405,000. 14 agents, I can tell you, a police officer today with benefits and without overtime is probably worth about $75,000 a year out of a general fund budget. So just our wages alone are approximately $1 million. There is some deviation throughout the state, and I think that's one of the beauties of the system we have, is we heard loud and clear from all of our constituents around the state that local control is a huge component of this. We want to have the flexibility to meet the needs in Hibbing that may be different from the needs in Brooklyn Park, to be quite frank with you. So funding, it's a competitive process, and you're able to structure it if you can afford to not provide a large portion of your budget towards wages, and it's operating, and that works in Hibbing, it may not work here, or vice versa. So it does not include local dollars, and that is not represented in there.
But Chief Setter, just so I'm clear, the local units pay the salaries for all of these folks who are listed on here, is that right?
Madam Chair, that's correct. They pay the majority of that. There's some limited overtime reimbursement depending on the particular grantee.
Okay. Questions? Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Chief Setter, I want to congratulate you for the fine work that you've done in these teams, and I'm really proud of the fact that you're a member of my legislative district. And, so I want to thank you for that. One of the things that I saw in yesterday's Washington Post was an issue that said that there was over 1,500 stolen weapons or lost weapons and about 1,200 lost portable computers by the FBI. And many of them contained especially data that was hard to reach. Have you sustained any similar problems?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, no, we haven't. And I saw that article, too, something like 3 or 4 laptops are stolen from the FBI every month or something like that. And, you know, I think one of the things that works successfully for us is the fact that perhaps we are not as advanced in that technology. Local government, you know, we don't have a lot of laptops floating around for our line investigators. I know that FBI agents, the day they check into the academy and start, they have a laptop assigned to them. And I've had officers from my agency that have gone on to be FBI agents. I can remember one telling me he has 4 computers, and he's not even sure what 3 of them are for. So, you know, it's I'm not being critical of the agency by any stretch of the imagination, but it's easy to be overcome by the amount of information you can have available to you. One of the things I can tell you from working on this project for a number of years, both on the line side and certainly as a police chief and being involved in the different oversight councils, is that the amount of work and the quality of work that's being done by these investigators throughout the state is beyond belief. They do phenomenal work. They're working in a difficult environment. We do it within limited resources, and I think one of the weaknesses that we fought all of the years that I've been a participant here is we're constantly struggling with enough funding just to maintain operations. As Madam Chair pointed out, there's a map that you have in your handout. The unfortunate part of that is the white components show areas that are not in the task force. Certainly that's been an initiative of the legislature to try and broaden our engagement throughout the state. I think it's critical. But without increased funding, it's going to be very, very difficult to do. We have enough money just to maintain today. And part of that is a challenge we come in splitting our funding between the state funding and the federal funding. And at some point, I think we need to have a discussion in Minnesota how to combine that and really look at meaningful expansion so we can have the entire state covered. And with that, also, Senator, I'd appreciate your comments, but I certainly can't take credit for any of this. The staff at the DPS has been phenomenal, but more importantly, there has been a lot of dialogue, a large number of meetings, and I think a tremendous amount of buy-in into combining these two initiatives into one oversight council and really trying to coordinate not only the operational level, but the oversight management of this concept throughout the state of Minnesota. And I firmly believe that we have a great model that could easily be replicated throughout the country.
Other questions? Senator Moore.
Chief, I am struck on page 12 on the 2006 task force accomplishments, and particularly in bullet number 3 about seized or purchased, that that there were 154 firearms that were seized. Even though this was not a, it is not a weapons task force, then in the activities that the that's being done with the gang and drug task force, that we're even getting to the firearms. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because, you know, we had a very revealing hearing with Minneapolis and St. Paul with the two chiefs and the two mayors. And the one area that really stuck with me was hearing my own chief of police say that, you know, we need a coordinating system like this to get guns off the streets. And I'm struck with, you know, that this is a good number of firearms. Is this as a result of part of the gang enforcement area that we're getting these firearms off the streets? And then the other question I'd like you to comment on is there more we can do to help you do more in the area of firearms? So if you can offer some thoughts on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Maul, let me respond to those two questions in two parts. Yes, the data you see here, and I would suggest that a data of 154 firearms last year is probably it's underrepresentative of what the real threat is out in the community. I can tell you, I've been in law enforcement for 30 years, 28 of which in Brooklyn Park, and the communities in which we operate in today are far, far more dangerous than anything I've experienced in my entire career. As you may know, as recently as 3 weeks ago, we had a homicide in our community where two people were murdered in a parking lot of an apartment complex. I can tell you from my knowledge of that particular investigation, it was a lover's quarrel type of thing, but the two suspects in that case are gangster disciples. An assault rifle, an AK-47 type of assault rifle, was utilized. Over 20 rounds were fired from the rifle. And there is evidence to indicate it possibly could have been fully automatic. For me to sit here and testify before you as to that type of firearm being on the street and talking to my colleagues throughout law enforcement, it's shocking. It's shocking on a number of fronts. Number one, those type of firearms are out there. Secondly, it's shocking that they're being used in crimes of passion, more so than what you would see in a organized type of crime gang hit. But I can tell you, after having been in that scene, it looked like something I'd seen in a textbook from Chicago in 1935. It was absolutely disgusting with the amount of firepower that was used in that instant. So with that being said, is yes, there are a lot of firearms out there. It's far more dangerous. The people using them are more likely to use them. They're younger. The types of conflicts that will generate or will denigrate into an armed conflict are unbelievable. It's small things that get into big issues. I think the coordination, to answer the second part of your question about what more we can do, I think I would appeal to the legislature on behalf of the Oversight Council that we really need to think about expanding our scope, not in what we're doing, but in the number of agencies we can get to participate. Those with 32 or so gang investigators in the metropolitan area, to be quite frank with you, that is not enough. We have 32 in there because we're limited in as to how we are able to fund them. We reimbursed metro area gang investigators to the parent agency at $40,000 per officer. With the funding, we're able to pay for 32 officers. What that means, in common terms, in Brooklyn Park, I assign an investigator over there. I have to provide a car, his personal equipment or her personal equipment, and so forth. The gang, the Metro Gang Strike Force provides the office space, the computers, the supervision and everything. But I get $40,000 back. Well, the officer on the front end costs me $75,000. On top of that, then, there's overtime. And just this last homicide case as a great example in Brooklyn Park. Members of the Oversight Council or members of the Gang Strike Force assisted us. The Golden Valley investigator assigned had over 50 hours of overtime in the first 2 weeks. That overtime rate is probably right around $35 an hour. So the city of Golden Valley actually absorbs a pretty significant dollar amount helping Brooklyn Park out. That in and of itself is the beauty and the weakness of the program. The gang investigators have a lot of work to do. We certainly work all throughout not only the metro area but the state of Minnesota. And we need more money, to be honest with you, to get more investigators and get that reimbursement up so we can garner a wider range of participation. I'm convinced that's one of the key steps towards a solution in this regard.
Chief Sutter, I'm not sure it will help, but I did send a letter to the entire Minnesota delegation asking them to up the burn grants.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
From what I can understand, the House passed their budget bill with, you know, some amount of burn grants, but the Senate bill has nothing in it. And so I guess it will go to conference committee, and we know around here that conference committees usually come out someplace in the middle, and I'm hoping that they can, you know, go beyond. But I did send a letter last week to each one of them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's my understanding that we will also be making the same presentation or similar presentation on the House side, so I'll have the opportunity to have the same discussion with them.
Good. So the biggest thing we can do to help you is to get you some more money.
Yes, ma'am. That would be very helpful.
Right.
I know. I'm the first person to sit here and say
I'm
that,
sure.
Of course.
Yes. Senator Moi.
But, Chief, are there operational things that beyond I know that the public safety, whether that's in the Gang and Drug Oversight Council or the various police departments or, you know, I mean, that need is out there, outstanding. And, frankly, we need to have the bodies out there. So we'll work on that piece in terms of the salaries and the bodies being out there. But are there other things like and I noticed in here you talked about an informational system, sharing system, that would be helpful to the council, but also that may be helpful perhaps in an effort, you know, a multi-jurisdictional effort to look at arms and, you know, getting arms off the streets or with, you know, working with different jurisdictions on other things. Are there infrastructural things that we ought to be thinking about that would be helpful?
Chief Sutter.
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, yeah, the informational system, to be quite frank to you, is really critical. We run into obstacles in Minnesota because of the Data Practices Act, our ability to retain information and disseminate it, keep it confidential when it's an active investigation. And it's one of the things I think that has been very successful on the gang side of this with the implementation of GangNet almost 10 years ago and the management of that system. We don't have anything like that on the drug enforcement side. One of the things we did do through the 2006 grant process is every grantee, everyone that applies for a grant with us of these 20-some task forces has to agree to provide information into GangNet and the gang pointer system, which is helpful. We do know that many of these offenders do cross jurisdictional boundaries, and the best way to take care of violent offenders, to be quite frank with you, is to build the best criminal case you can and put them in prison for the longest time. We're not talking about people necessarily that are amenable to treatment. They're violent criminals that use weapons, whether it's in gang crime or in drug crimes, and sharing that information is really the key, and it's very astute of you to make that observation. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, too, Chief. I know I've been involved in this operation in many different ways over the years, being sheriff, part of the West Central Drug Task Force, and I think I can't emphasize enough to this group, I wish they were all here, but to this group that this is probably one of the areas we really have to pay attention to here in the state of Minnesota. When we talk about gang activity, I don't think we can really appreciate it. I think there's people in this room that can come up and tell us some stories that we probably don't want to hear, and for sure our kids don't want to hear. But the reality of it is that these people are nasty folks we're dealing with out here. And the chief is very right. When they commit crimes, they are committing crimes, and they need to be absolutely tucked away for a long period of time. And we really have to pay attention to this. We have to fund it. The quality of our life in Minnesota depends on us paying close attention to it. So I applaud the group for doing the work that they're doing with what's such minimal dollars. And if it wasn't for the cooperation really between the local units of government as well as the state and everybody, this would never happen. So thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Chief Sutter, would you talk a little bit about the Oversight Council? Who's on this council? And I know a lot of councils that the legislature set up have spots for legislators. And would you tell us who the legislators are?
Madam Chair, on the Oversight Council, there are no legislators. Actually, the statute defines a membership, and that's, of course, the one question I don't have right in front of me. I can tell you that when the 2005 legislation was developed, and maybe there's a staff person that has, nobody has it here. I can tell you there are six chiefs selected by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, six sheriffs selected by the Minnesota Sheriffs Association that are the broader component. But by definition, the chiefs from St. Paul in Minneapolis and the sheriffs from Ramsey County and Hennepin County are on it by default. Thank you very much. I've just been provided with a statute. The director of the Office of Special Investigations, as a representative of the Commissioner of Corrections, is assigned. The superintendent of the BCA is a member by statute. The attorney general. And we also have our counsel for the Oversight Council is from the Attorney General's office. I'm sorry, it's eight chiefs of police and eight sheriffs. I misspoke earlier. Two county attorneys selected by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Representative from the Drug Task Force is the Minnesota State Narcotics Officers Association that has a member that has a seat, so we have that operational representative. Command level representative of the Gang Strike Force, Commander Ryan is on it, and I can tell you the assistant commander from the Gang Strike Force, both of them attend our meetings regularly. Then we have federal partners from the DEA, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the FBI that have seats. A tribal police officer from the Minnesota Tribal Law Enforcement Association. And then we have two additional members selected by the Oversight Council. I mentioned Carol Fokowski from Hazelden Foundation is one of our board seats, and I'm going to have to apologize. I don't recall who the other one is off the top of my head. Thank you for the statute, though. It's very helpful.
Other questions? And I think the statute also says that you report to the legislature on you give an annual report each year.
Madam
February?
Chair, that's correct.
And that's coming?
Yes.
Or is it already here?
It's the strategy. Madam Chair, that strategy would be our annual report this year. Last year, I personally... Yes. It's not the overhead. There's actually a document with the strategy.
There is?
It was mailed out to the legislature.
Okay.
And we'll follow up with you to make sure that you know what it looks like.
It's probably on a pile somewhere that I haven't gotten to yet. I apologize. Okay. Any other questions? Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of interest. Would it be, you can obviously see how close this is to me. Would it be inappropriate or appropriate to have somebody from this committee be assigned to that oversight committee, or would that be way out of whack?
Chief Sutter, are there some at-large seats on that list?
Madam Chair, we may have one of the public seats that is not filled yet, and we would be happy even to have a member of the legislature.
Members.
And Carol Fokowski has the other one.
Carol has one.
We do have a vacant at-large seat, so we would be more than happy to have a representative, and I would also suggest that anybody that is interested from the legislature, we'd be more than happy to have you make those meetings available to you and have you attend. We typically meet at the Department of Corrections in a conference room at Energy Park on a quarterly basis.
Okay. Senator Engelbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would encourage anybody else but myself to do that. I really would, seriously, because I was part of that process, but if anybody's interested in it, I think it's crucial.
I think it would be a good idea with Senator Moore.
Well, Madam Chair, typically on these councils or commissions, if we if there is a public policy desire to have the a legislative member participate, I think we put that in statute to have them participate so that then the individuals go through a process to be appointed either by the Rules Committee chair or the speaker to sit on there, just so that there's some oversight over the participation of our member on the task force. In all, I think, cases where, you know, we've got someone who feels very strongly as an advocate, I think the relationship is good. If there's some, you know, tension, I think we would need some other process. And I'm not quite sure if the legislative member is sitting on that commission or that council, whether they ought to be voting, a voting member. I don't know what the practice is, but I'm just kind of thinking that there might be some conflict issues that might arise.
Well, I know the boards that I sit on are all, I'm always ex officio.
Yeah.
I don't know about other Senator Foley.
In my case, that's not the same, Madam Chair. I serve on the Criminal and Juvenile Information Task Force that essentially now is fully responsible for the CRIMNET, and that's a statutory provision for the majority leader to choose somebody from the Senate and the Speaker to select somebody from the House.
All right. Senator Ingebretson, that might be a good bill for you to get drafted, and I think there's kind of a sense of
with the Senator that when you're starting to ask for money and you're sitting on that committee, certainly gets to be an issue.
Yeah.
It's more of an informative thing. That's why
sure.
I brought it up, and I
yep.
think it's just a better way for everybody to understand the real world we're talking about when we're talking about nasty folks out there, and to get it firsthand would be a great place to get it.
I think so, and maybe Mr. Backus can get that drafted, and if you wanted to carry that, I'm sure you would have a whole host of co-authors
who would
help you with that. Okay, any other questions? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators.
All right. See, the other item on the agenda today is the Financial Crimes Task Force, and we have a whole big notebook here of information from this task force. Oh, I forgot to ask. Is there anybody in the audience who wants to talk to us about the gang and drug task force? Thought he was going to. Okay. All right. All right. Let's go on to the Financial Crimes Task Force. Whenever we get the computer. Members, I see also in our folder in the packet today we have the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on CRIMNET for you to look at your leisure. They did identify some problems. And that's hot off the press from last week. Or warm off the press, I guess. And there's also a letter from the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agent Services. We had asked for a schedule of license fees charged by the agency, and that's in your folder as well. They're not small. Gentlemen, whenever you're ready to start, just go right ahead.
I'll hear it for you. Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Johnson. I'm the Anoka County Attorney.
Well,
and I'm also the chair of the Financial Crimes Task Force. I'm joined, and they'll introduce themselves, but by John McCullough and by Mark Johnson, who's the acting commander of the task force. They'll handle parts of this presentation. Let me give you some perspective as to my interest in this particular area. First of all, let me advise you that done a fair amount of work outside of Anoka County and outside of Minnesota. I'm a past president of the National District Attorneys Association. I'm currently chair of the ABA criminal justice section. So I've seen a lot of criminal justice systems over the years. And that plays into something that I want to say initially with regard to this. I will tell you that this Financial Crimes Task Force began in 97 as a result of Judy Cook accosting me outside Room 15, inquiring why we weren't taking care of her clients. That led to a meeting with the retailers and the bankers and law enforcement, other county attorneys and myself, together with police and sheriffs. And as they explained what they were seeing in the retail and financial sector, we were, frankly, from a law enforcement perspective, amazed, because we had no idea that the issue was as large as it was. We would see the crimes that occurred in cities, city by city, or county by county at a sheriff's level. Frankly, oftentimes the sheriffs didn't see it because the city captured it. There might be 5 bad checks in one city, 10 in another. It was not a big deal. But when you looked metro-wide, it was a really big deal. People from Target and people from Walmart and other retailers would come in and say, we're suffering hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars of theft, and you're not paying any attention to it. And they were right, because we were looking at it from a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction level, and in each jurisdiction taken separately, it was not a big deal. We frankly weren't aware of the size of the problem. What we did, why don't you go ahead, John, was initially start talking about checks. And the retailers, particularly, developed a database of checks that attempted to identify patterns and did identify patterns, where they would see the same types of checks passed in different cities, and they would be able to identify organized criminal activity as a result of that. And what we have here, and this would be perhaps the appropriate time to say it, is a unique blend of something that was really new in law enforcement, and that was bringing the victims into the discussion of the enforcement piece. In other words, the Retail Protective Association built this database, made it accessible for law enforcement around the metro area. No fees, just kind of log into it. You can start to see organized criminal activity. In addition, we started to have some departments. We had an investigator, Mary Myers in Woodbury, who started taking an interest in patterns that were outside her city. We had the Minneapolis Police Department taking an interest in what was going on outside because they saw this organized activity. The difficulty that they were facing was, as they would be working on cases that were outside their jurisdiction but a part of the same organized activity, the chiefs would start tapping them on the shoulder and saying, don't we have enough crime in Woodbury or Minneapolis? Why are you working on a case out of St. Cloud or in Oakdale or some other city? As we started to work this, we started to see more and more of this. And it was all built initially at an informal level, as where we didn't have any organization. We just had people working cooperatively together. The county attorneys got together because of some unique venue statutes. In other words, what cases I can prosecute in Anoka County. Legislature had the wisdom at some time in the past to say, if you've got a theft case out of Anoka County and you can show that that was a part of an organized criminal activity, you can prosecute all those theft cases throughout Minnesota in Anoka County. We ended up taking the first major multi-jurisdictional case. It was actually a case out of Target where we pulled it together, made a major case, and sent a person to prison for some time. All the county attorneys in the metro area agreed that they would take these cases. There are a number of statutes that provide this type of value, if you will, where we can take cases outside of our jurisdiction. What we're starting to see with this task force, and frankly with the gang strike force, with their drugs and the gangs, is something that is really has to happen. For the last 150 years, we've been operating on a city-by-city basis, county-by-county basis, and that was fine 100 years ago. But criminals now have become much more organized, much more mobile, and they do things across county lines, across city lines. At some point in time, I believe we're going to have to step back in this state, as I've seen in other states and, frankly, in other countries, and try to break down these jurisdictional boundaries so that we can follow the crime where it is and we can pursue it. We can pursue organized crime in an organized manner. We are not at that point now. Right now we have some task forces. You've got the gang strike force. You've got this task force pursuing this. I'd suggest to you that this is not the ultimate of where we're going to go in the future in terms of approaching criminal activity. You'll see as we get into this the way that it transcends geographical boundaries. And at some point in time, as a state, we're going to have to step back and figure out if we're doing criminal justice structurally in the best way that we can. We haven't done much of that at all. We still pursue it much the way that we have. We still have city attorneys. We have county attorneys doing both civil and criminal. Every state does it differently. Many states don't have city attorneys. Many states don't have prosecutors who handle corporate counsel work for the county in addition to doing the criminal work. What's the best way of doing it? That's a discussion that we should have. Should we have police department, sheriff's office, and highway patrol? Or should we think about a more organized approach to that? These have been kind of sacred cows, and there would be a lot of resistance. I can tell you there would be a lot of resistance if you get into telling county attorneys that they shouldn't be corporate counsel and also be the prosecutor. We've had that discussion before, but it's a discussion that should be held. You get resistance from city attorneys if you say county attorneys should do all the prosecution in the county, particularly in the smaller counties, because cities like to hold on to that authority. But it's a discussion that should be held. And the discussion should expand to include these task forces that are popping up, driven by need, but they're popping up kind of in an ad hoc way, and they survive because they're doing good work. They're addressing things that could not be addressed in the existing structure before these task forces came into being. Anyway, the legislature recognized this and codified the task force in about 2000 as it moved and gave some initial funding for it. As it moved forward and we got into the budget crunch that we all remember, the legislature did not fund it, but the U.S. attorney, because the U.S. attorney believed that this was an important undertaking, stepped forward to fund the continued work of the task force by an extraordinary restitution award that he was able to achieve. Tom Heffelfinger really believed in this work because he saw the crimes that were being committed that weren't being pursued because there was not the ability to investigate it across jurisdictional boundaries and particularly in greater Minnesota. Then we came to 2005. And we did receive funding at that time. We received $1.5 million for biennial funding. And in 2006, there was $354,000 that was added to the funding. And we're at that point now for it. Go ahead, John. In that 2005 legislation, the structure was changed. An oversight council was created. Go ahead, John. And there you have the structure of the oversight council. I will say that with the discussion that you had about the gang strike force, we do have a legislator on the task force. Senator Chaudhry has been, shall we say, a very active member of the Oversight Council.
And
Zellers.
Zellers.
Representative Zellers. I might say that Senator Chaudhry has been particularly active.
Very.
But there you have the structure of the task force. You see that I'm the chair of that. That's not an additional position. I am the county attorney representative on the council. It's a somewhat smaller council. This is not a position I particularly sought. I will say I took it simply because I believe in this mission. I believe that we have to be able to investigate these crimes across jurisdictional boundaries, and because Tom Heffelfinger asked me to do it. And I'm hoping to be able to hand that off at some point in time. Go ahead, John. This is the mission that the task force has. And I don't need to read it to you. You can pick it up. I'm going to turn it over to the interim commander, Mark Johnson, and then in turn to the coordinator, business coordinator, John McCullough. I want to emphasize, so I don't have to break back in later, the business piece of this has been particularly important to me, to be able to interact directly with the financial community and the retail community, have their concerns, and you saw some of it in the Oversight Council, their concerns presented to us. It's the first time in my experience where we've engaged with the people who have a large part of these problems directly and been able to work with them to address some of the issues that they face. I will also say that at a meeting a few days ago with Target Corporation, they made a presentation to the county attorneys about their concern about organized retail crime and how that's proliferating and how gangs are taking that on and stealing very significant amounts of money in organized activity and selling it through eBay and other ways to, which has become kind of the new pawn shop. They're very concerned about that. And if we're going to address the concerns of institutions that represent a large part of our economy, in my view, we have to pay attention to them and have them at the table when we talk about what their problems are. And I'll turn this over to the interim task force commander, Mark Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Mark Johnston. I'm with the St. Paul Police Department, currently serving as the interim commander of the task force. I have 32 years of experience in law enforcement. I've been involved in investigation of most types of crimes that one can imagine. I will just start out with our results here. I'll try to go through this rather quickly. If you have any questions at any time, please feel free to interrupt me. In the past fiscal year, we have charged 1,927 cases. These are cases. These are not individuals. This can be anywhere from six individuals up involved in them. We've executed 235 search warrants, made 270 arrests on scene, 16 federal indictments, recovered eight firearms, seized 64 computers, done 59 forensic exams on these computers, and entertained individuals and attended 35 intel and training meetings. We have the unique responsibility of trying to track organized crime groups. They travel all over the state, and not just our state, in other states. We primarily deal with the people in our state and primarily the metro area, but we do get out into the other five states as well. This is a map showing how these crime groups will track where they've been so they don't go into other jurisdictions repeatedly. They do this in order to avoid detection and prosecution. Organized groups involve usually 6 to 8 top-level individuals. They use different individuals, with they call runners, with clean records, clean identifications. We usually, what we say, mule counterfeit checks. These individuals are recruited. They go out, try to cash a counterfeit check. Their split will be anywhere from 20 to 50%. They take the risk. The top people take the profit. These criminal groups usually operate within the metropolitan area as far as getting their money, what they're really after. They house in any number of places. Many of them are finding out of the metro area now. This is just an example of one group. This is a Randy Simmons group. And I'm trying to remember, I think they had like 67 individuals within this group. You're seeing the hierarchy of that group right there. Our cases are complex. The reason they're complex is they involve personal information stolen from victims. We have to first determine how that information is stolen. Many of our victims don't know that they've been victimized. Victims may have been robbed. Their mail have been stolen, car broken in, burglaries, home invasions, any number of things. Banks, credit unions, merchants are often financial victims as well. Victims are usually left to try to repair their personal lives and financial lives and credit history on their own without much help. Financial crimes continue with problems with documentation of what happens. In what we do, we have to be sure the identity of the individual who's up there actually offering that check, credit card, whatever, who's stealing that identity. It's not as easy as other crimes are. We have to go through photo lineups, closed circuit television, providing samples of handwriting, doing fingerprint analysis, following consumer privacy laws, bank laws. And many times we have difficulties because we have a major bank that has a customer whose account is compromised and they've just spent thousands of dollars out of their account fraudulently. They don't like to come to the forefront and say, oh, sure, here you are, here's the documentation. So we have a difficulty with that. We have to do an incredible amount of interviews and transcribing to keep our documentation straight. We do an inordinate amount of surveillance. Our evidence collection and analysis of other victims' items is very profound. We do computer forensics on our own, in our own task force. We have one individual that does this, and I believe he did like 60 computers in the past year. We had to pull the hard drives, crack the codes, and take the information out of there.
Excuse me, Commander. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question back on number 16 there. You said the victims are the care themselves. Do they not get any victim from help from the Victims Reparation Board at all? Do they get some or not enough?
Madam Chair, Senator, they do. The way when my own personal operation is from the victim witness coordinator through the county attorney's office in Ramsey County, which is where I work out of primarily, does we are working with them as much as we can. Having 6 members of our task force, we do not, personally, I could not speak to how far we are involved with those folks.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, the Reparations Board is another one of those groups, if I'm not wrong, that is funded by Byrne Grants. And I think in the governor's budget, he's proposing to put some state money into that so they don't get totally whacked by the Byrne Grants going down in size.
Thank you.
Commander.
Madam Chair and Senators, I believe the Victims Reparation Board actually covers violent crimes. We do work with our victim witness coordinator programs within in the counties for reparations in that respect.
Well, yeah.
Oh, so they aren't eligible when they have financial crimes against them?
Beg your pardon?
So that reparations is just for violent crimes?
Violent crimes, correct.
Oh, okay.
Okay, this is an example of the first page of one spreadsheet from one case. In this particular case, we had 240 counterfeit checks presented in 22 different jurisdictions for over $15,000 by one offender. This case listed over 324 transactions encompassing 11 victims. We have no idea how many other victims may have been out there that we were not able to find. These are two suspect homes. The one on the left is approximately 40 miles to the northwest of our current location. This home was unique because not only did it house a counterfeiting operation, it also housed a large meth lab and a porn studio. It was inhabited by about six different criminal individuals who were career criminals. It contained one .357 Magnum that we had to deal with. The house on the right is approximately 60 miles directly north of our location. This is more of a blue-collar, more unsophisticated. However, this operation used counterfeit checks to purchase things like trucks, snowmobiles, bobcats, construction equipment, motorcycles, whatever. And this was kind of the focal point, dropping-off point. What was unique about this house, there were two suspects in it when we hit it, and they had three loaded high-power rifles and four loaded 12-gauge shotguns with buckshot. In each of these instances, when we do a search warrant, we do have to make a tactical entry, usually at the break of day, and deal with those circumstances. The house on the left, this is the house on the left. Go ahead, John. These are the inhabitants of that home. Go ahead. These are some of the items. Generally on the street, you get $250 for a checkbook. So somebody breaking into a house, car, whatever, you get a checkbook. You can take it to one of the players. They'll give you $250 cash right up front, and you're good to go. But these are some of the other items. This was from the meth lab. We actually had to call the DEA in to take this meth lab down because it was so large. This encompassed about 12 hours of our time start to finish. Suspects use financial information to gamble as well. Your identity can be stolen from any number of things, and some of you might go on the internet and use it to gamble, and you'll never know if you were lucky or not until you get the bill and you find out you're not lucky, as many of our victims have. Weapons. Here are some of the other weapons that we've recovered. There's an old saying, money is the root of all evil. You follow the money, you find lots of other things. We find weapons, we find drugs, we find pornography. These people like their money, they like their accoutrements, and they're not afraid to defend them from other perpetrators or law enforcement. This is a shot of our property room. Last year we seized over 60 computers that we did forensic exams on. Go ahead. This is the first page of a computer forensic report. We have one individual that does these forensic exams. To start out, he has to crack the code, which will be anywhere from 4 to 6 passwords, and get in. Once in, we find out all the checks that have been made on that computer and put into a format, which is a very, very important part of what we do. Go ahead. These are computer tools used by criminals. They are very sophisticated, and they know their business. Okay. Counterfeit identifications, one of my favorites. So the gateway to everything, whether it be cashing checks, buying things fraudulently, or driving on the street because you no longer have driving privileges. Go ahead. Financial freedom forever. This is a template in a computer of one of our suspects. We have seen this in many of them. Here is the old license versus the new license. You see the criminals have adopted to counterfeit the new driver's license already. They use the state stamps. They use glittery eyeshadow to put the nice background in like we have, all those good things. Go ahead. Another thing you can do, you can go on Google. Google fakeids.com. You can get any number of IDs you'd like. Go ahead.
Senator Rosen.
Minnesota
Excuse
ID.
Excuse me
or,
just a second.
Yes.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to slide 28, the counterfeit IDs. What's the going rate for a counterfeit ID right now on the street?
Well, you can buy one on the internet for $70. On the street, if you come up with a checkbook, like if I broke into your car and stole your purse, had your checkbook, and had your driver's license, I might just send the driver's license right along with your checkbook or credit card. I might get a little bump of $25 to $50 for the license. Or if somebody was in an operation where they had some mules that they wanted to get out there real quick, they might pop them $100 real quick for a license like that. But the only problem is once that license is taken, it's out there and it's used repetitively.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Do you do much with the counterfeit IDs with the illegal immigrants?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, we do. We track those, and what we try to do, we try to target the people that are victimizing the people that are immigrants, because most of those folks come in, they're given this ID, they're given a Social Security number, they don't really know who it belongs to, and they may not have a clear understanding of where they came from or what really the laws are that apply. We try to pluck these people out that are preying upon not only our identity theft victims, but folks like these that are trying to work and support their families.
Madam Chair. And another financial crime is that I understand that those IDs for those immigrants are going for $500 a pop out on the street. So there's a discrepancy there as far as there's quite a black market.
Madam Chair, Senator, correct.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, please. FakeIDs.com.
Ah. Yes, like I said, here we see Minnesota IDs or driver's license. Buy them on the internet for $70. I mean, put in your favorite person. More fake IDs we deal with. This is publicdata.com. This is one of my personal favorites. This is actually housed outside of our country. Is it in the? I can't remember the location. The Cayman Islands. Okay, they're in the Cayman Islands. You can go on publicdata.com and bring up information, personal, financial, whatever, on pretty much anybody you like and pay the price for it. Go ahead. Counterfeiting.
Senator Neville?
Pardon.
How does that publicdata.com work? You need to have a Social Security number, a driver's license number, as an entry to the public data, or just a name and date of birth?
Madam Chair and Senator, you go on and you just pay the fee for that. You can use any identity you want, and if you have a stolen computer, you have an IP address that can't be tracked, and being that it's going outside of this country for the information, it's not going to be tracked anyway. So it's pretty much open. As long as you want to pay the freight for it, you get the information.
Well, does this give you information about a victim, or does this create public data for a thief? I'm not clear about that.
I'll let John finish this, Madam Chair.
Sure, Mr. McCullough.
My name is John McCullough. I'm the business coordinator for the task force. So the way this particular website works, you would have to sign up, pay a fee, either with your credit card. You can do it by check, but they prefer a credit card. And at that point, they'll give you up to, they got different ranges, like for $20, $19, you can do 200 searches on any name that you want to look. So if you want to look up a Thompson, you may do this. Minnesota is not the only state that they have data on. The state has cut this off last year after we detected that and worked with the commissioner on shutting this down, and it was. Fortunately, they are outside the state, United States, and we are trying to go after them to continue to stop what they're doing. But jurisdictionally, we're having a problem. But you can search any name. So if you have a Thompson, Michael Thompson was one of our notorious criminals that kept on looking up names with Michael Thompson and making IDs with that, and people all over the state with Michael Thompson IDs that he had made ended up with a lot of credit bills that they didn't expect.
Madam Chair and Senators, counterfeiting titles, birth certificates, et cetera, on the internet is another venue that's used as well. Criminals, this primarily pertains to things stolen from the mail. And I will just say that we work very closely with the postal inspectors because of the extraordinary range of the U.S. mail and where it is stolen from. After it is stolen, it's sent to different places and actually used. They will steal primarily at the end of the month. It's good to hit the mailboxes. People will buy a $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 house, and they'll have a $995 mailbox with the flag up. It tells the perpetrators, our bills are here, our checks are here, come get them. They come get them, take them home, tear them open, soak them in Rain-X, whatever. It takes the ink out of them. Then they rewrite the checks for whatever amount they wish, or they just simply take the information and counterfeit it and make their own checks. Go ahead. Home-generated checks are very prevalent. Here we see VersaCheck, This particular style is VersaCheck Online. You can make one online. You can go to Office Max, buy check blanks. You can do any number of things. Okay. We have counterfeit checks and counterfeit identifications by the thousands as a result. Here we have an example of counterfeiting the new Minnesota IDs like I talked about before. Our suspects or perpetrators are very adept at this. They've already figured this out, and they're in business. Criminals use these tools for doing it primarily. You see everything from PDAs to cameras, cutters, torches, whatever. They're very ingenuitive. Okay. The impact on victims, businesses, and law enforcement. Technology we have today has made counterfeiting very easily. It overwhelms local law enforcement agencies. Victim venues issues where multiple crimes are being committed in different jurisdictions create a real problem. Businesses take the financial loss. It helps to resolve things with the victims, but they pass that loss on to the customers, which is all of us. Victims are punished by a system because they're harassed by collection agencies who, if your checks are stolen and counterfeited, the first thing that's going to happen, it's going to have your name on it, your account, and they're going to come after you for restitution for it. And the collection people hear a lot of excuses, and they don't really care what the victims are saying at that particular point in time. Criminals stay below the dollar radar with the hope that no investigators will pick up the crimes. What they'll do, they'll have people go out and they'll do a multitude of checks, keep it under a certain dollar figure because it doesn't come up. It's not a big thing, and everybody tries to pass it off like, well, it's okay. But, you know, if you have somebody doing $300 checks, it doesn't take very many of them to mount up. Okay. Minnesota Financial Crime Task Force experience. We have become the financial crime experts. Our people are very skilled at finding these criminals through our intelligence and the technical practices we employ. These cases are all solvable. We're highly efficient. We're sought after by jurisdictions throughout the state to help them. We partnership with many other law enforcement agencies as a rule, not an exception. I will turn this over to John McCullough. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McCullough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I get the fun part. I get all the financial numbers. Sue Perkins is over here just waiting to see what I'm going to say about this. She has not audited my numbers yet. I'm going to give you kind of a high-level overview, get down to some nitty line item details that you may or may not be interested in, but I think it's important for the committee to understand some of the level that we have to deal with, and then also get into some of the contributions the business community has made towards helping the task force continue going forward. I want to talk about general data to get into this. This will talk primarily about the number of cases again, and then getting into the financial piece. Our intelligence database right now, we're forecasting 14,000 entries, which may contain 4,500 names in one case. So there's going to be 14,000 separate cases keyed this year alone by two crime analysts. And we'll be going, and we use that information to really find the bad guy. That's what we use the data for. And also when other agencies are calling in and checking, say, hey, you got anything on John McCullough, they'll use that database to track down some financial documents that they may have been involved in. Caseload per investigator. This task force is generating more cases than I like to see per investigator. They're carrying, I fear every day that I'm going to come in and find one of them at the desk dead. Seriously. Their caseloads and their concern towards the victims are extremely high. They just can't say no when they hear a victim on the other side of the phone saying, I need help. Our forecast now looks like they're going to start clearing over 300. That's max. They can't do any more than that. They won't have a family life. They won't have anything else to do. So we're at that point right now per investigator to take on any more cases. There just isn't any more room. Cases charged, similar trend. If you go back, look at it, there's not much difference. We're doing about 1,900 cases, as Mark had mentioned earlier. You start looking at the individual cases, it's when you're dealing with one case, one person, and then you start looking at all those transactions that they're involved in, that requires you to locate the business, get the business to provide you with the information, go into the bank. I can go through them, you know, the investigative pieces that have to go in place for a county prosecutor to say, we're going to find this person guilty. And the only way we can do it is by meeting these threshold hurdles. And typically, you start thinking about calling 45 people on one case, calling them about the identification cards that you have just recovered and have to add that to the case. It's a daunting task for the individual staff as well as the investigators, but we do a highly efficient job at it. Now, moving into the state funding piece, initially in 2000, we had Minneapolis PD, the police department, provide an officer, and we had a couple Gold Valley, we had Maple Grove, and a few others that had initially come in to assist us without any funding, and then we went to the legislature and received some seed money in our first initial statute. That was in 2001, 2002. We went back to the legislature when you guys were very much aware of the deficit that we had. We asked for money, and see ya. And Tom Heffelfinger fortunately had an extraordinary restitution account with $1.2 million that he provided us. And I think he provided the Gang and Drug Task Force additional revenues, too, that year. So he bridged us and said, get back there in 2005 and see if you can pick up some your basic operating funding going forward, which we did. 2006, last year, the legislature provided an actual $354,000 supplemental one time to assist us in our cases. We're estimating we're going to probably run that again in 2007 with the governor's budget of $750,000. We have some carryover because we couldn't spend that 206 money all in 1 year. So we have a little bit of carryover, and that's why you see the number jump a little bit. Our basic budget, if you look at that, we're at 1.5 in a biennium. We have the one-time supplemental, $354,000. So our base funding is 1.8. We have an administrative cost from DPS, and that's so they can make sure all our processes are in order. They take 46, and then we're down to 1.8. I have 12 items listed here, which basically crunches all our numbers down into 12 line items: personnel cost for the commander and investigators through 607. Then we have vehicle costs, additional. We have one additional metro investigator that supplemental funding provided us along with a vehicle. We have contracted services. That's for our administrative services and myself. We have operational costs, phones, computers, copier costs. And by the way, copier costs, as these cases start to mushroom, guess what we have to make triplicates of for the prosecutors? And it's a lot of paperwork that we have to move through that office. Unfortunately, we're able to get a brand new copier, which really has made life a whole lot easier than the one that we had before. I had to mention that because you wouldn't believe, if you don't have a copier that works and you're trying to do a case, that you never hear the end of it.
contracts in the CrimNet proposal this year, one of their items is something they're calling e-charging, which would be to be able to move that paper electronically from you to the prosecutor to the judge to whoever.
Oh, we'd like to sign up for that.
All right.
Then we have our just our general regional training sessions that we've put on through the state. We've also joined up with the Chiefs of Police Association. We worked with them on training throughout the state this last year. We've had three grants to greater Minnesota cities. We wanted to move this faster, but we, due to the commander's changeover, we're kind of right now just waiting for things to get on board. We had the money come available, and we had a re-strategy on how we're spending that money, and that should be I would say within the next, say, 3 to 4 weeks, we should be back on track with that spending. We have an office build-out. Naturally, as you grow, we needed more space, so we were able to expand our office complex and get some actual chairs and desks for the investigators and so forth. Now, the infrastructure, this is our central operations cost structure. Again, this is the commanders in this infrastructure spending. We have fringe and benefits, or taxes and fringe in there for 28, contracted services, training, equipment, office expense. So we have all the line items down and our spending and our balances remaining. Then if you look at the individual grants that the state has issued to Edina, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Ramsey County, and South Lake Minnetonka, along with the three greater Minnesota cities, we're at $1.1 million there. And then our base funding comes back, if you add it all back up, it's $1.8 million. Now, the contributions portions, which is what Bob had talked about, it has caused some problems for us. I had tried several times to approach some of the major corporations and said, you know, we need funding in order to get the $250,000. Very frankly, they feel that strong-arming, and that's buying a badge, and they're paying taxes. If they were to contribute, will the state allow us or the financial institution or the retailer to take a tax donation write-off on that? Well, we're not a 501c3. So they're hesitant to provide direct funding to the task force, particularly if services are performed directly for them. So let's say, for example, a major corporation retailer says, you know, I'll give you guys $90,000 to pay for an investigator. What do you think they want to do with that investigator?
They want to control them.
And if your budget is tied to... Now, I didn't know this. When we passed the contribution portion on there, I thought it was a great thing. I'm finding out there's a very big backlash in the approaches that you use to try to gain that support. You can tell the story. I've tried many, many different ways. It comes back to not being a 501c3. They want the tax write-off. Secondarily, the investigators, if their money's tied to our budget and they see the funding going away because we can't get a matching grant, what do you think they would say to Wells Fargo? That's a problem. Even though it's not directly said, hey, give us the money, it's a problem that we need to address in some other way. And I can talk about that at greater length if you'd like, but it's another story, maybe another day. However, the corporations and businesses have contributed. We had the auto theft grant, which is basically the funding from everybody pays for the auto theft fees, 50 cents each pay or each time you pay your insurance fee. You have contributions of cash and in-kind contributions of about $800,000. The auto theft, this was a unique grant that came out of the insurance fees. We originally forecasted only 22 vehicles being involved in all the cases that we had handled where someone would go out and get a fraudulent dealer loan, bank loan, buy a car from you personally with a counterfeit check. You name it. There's a number of ways they can do it through the internet, and they've done that. And bottom line is we've recovered over 80 vehicles for $1.2 million plus dollars, and you can see the cost is only $182,000. We don't know if that's going to be an ongoing program because that's in the commerce area. We'll ask for it. We'll see what would happen or if they're going to take that piece of that over. Cash contributions. Since I'm not a CPA, this is the best I could do. So I will say this, that the U.S. Attorney Office has right now in the bank in Anoka County $117,000 that we have in reserve. And we keep it there primarily to help us during contingency issues, grant bridging between when the state can issue a grant and when the funds become available. Underneath there, we had also spent out of that same fund, the remaining fund that Tom Heffelfinger provided, we spent $48,000 in a transition period for 3 months while grants were being written in that 205 period. Transition vehicles were included in that. We had some very serious problems in the location, which I'm not going to tell you, it's a hidden site, but it's in the northern suburbs and it's in a U.S. bank building. But we had some car break-ins and things of that nature where we had to increase lighting and a few other things to remove shrubs. Greater Minnesota Computer Forensics, we needed additional support for the Greater Minnesota. Getting down to the Postal Inspection Service, they've offered us $40,000 in grants over the same time period. We spent 21 of it. They've just told us that we have 20,000 more that they're going to grant us this year. MESIF, that's a Midwest Economic Crime Foundation, that is actually a 501c3 that we have now set up. Philip Morris has donated $15,000 to go after contribution cases, and Amex, which is an informant case that they paid out on. So we have a 501 process that we just started, and Mary Meyer is going to be the director for that corporation, which is a not-for-profit. We have also the retailers' donations of approximately $7,200. We have a reward fund that RPA provided $900 with some additional contributions from presentations that we provided. Here's the in-kind contributions, the intangibles. We have $160,000 in joint effort with the U.S. Postal Service personnel. We have U.S. Bank providing us office space and utilities and parking and trash and all that stuff. We have three investigators overtime. They donated over $4,400 or $44,000 during this period of their own time. Myself and others have donated voluntarily $8,000. We have Minneapolis. There's a fringe component there, $7,000 that was covered by Minneapolis. South Lake Minnetonka donated $8,000 for some programming on a case incident reporting system that we're developing. And we put a lot of desk cubicles in. We all did that ourselves, the investigators and myself, and we have 17 workstations currently right now. Half of them are used. We have a lot of people coming in from U.S. Secret Service, other agencies, working on their own individual cases using our information and what we do. So we are sharing space with other agencies. All other contributions are about $6,300 for 362. Overtime usage. Senator, you had asked me how are we using our overtime. I want to specifically address this. Of the overtime used for seven investigators on an annual basis, and I like to work on an annual basis, biennium sometimes gives us a different perception of what's happening. So we have $930,000 for seven investigators. You start breaking that down and I will say this, these are experienced investigators. Yes, we have a few younger investigators that come through the office, but if you're working financial fraud cases, it's really key to have very experienced investigators that have done multiple different types of law enforcement background to help us. Therefore, their hourly rate is $46.92 per hour, and if you start breaking that down by month, it's about $13,000 per year. It's $13,000 per investigator, 22 hours a month. And you start doing a search warrant, it goes pretty quick per investigator at 5 hours per week. And if you recall how many search warrants we do, that's one of our biggest problems we have is when you're doing a search warrant and there's kids, there's meth, there's other types of issues that move in a lot of evidence and tagging all that, your overtime does tend to run. I want to mention the computers to run a forensic exam on a lot of them are 80. We're seeing now hard drives with 300 gigs now. Takes an awful lot of time to do and look and search a 300-gig hard drive. The budget baseline, this is what the Oversight Council has requested and provided to the commissioner. And the commissioner's has looked at this and reviewed it, and I think our budget is still at $750,000. We're still looking for, on a biennium basis, 3.5. So we're at a big crossroads here. What happens if we don't get it? Well, the yellow here, if you turn to next page 58, the yellow is, You can move these numbers around. You might be able to put another investigator in the metro and not provide northern Minnesota. You may do other things with the computer forensics. But the dollars, you can move around. So this is kind of giving you an idea of what can be paid for at $750. What we're going to give up if we don't is the red line, the next page. So this kind of gives you kind of a visual of, you know, where we're at, where we'd like to go with the funding. After 32 years in working in the private sector, nothing happens without money. You just can't go after the criminals without having the funding support. And with that, I'll turn that back over to Bob.
Mr. McCullough, I have a question, and you know, I was an English major, so
yep.
Math comes hard for me. On page 50 in the book, you've got the personnel cost for the commander and four investigators at 807, and then vehicle costs split out separately.
That's 720, Madam Chair?
I'm sorry?
Page
50?
Yep, I'm on page 50.
Okay.
Which line item?
Items 1 and 2.
Okay.
So you've got the personnel costs and then the vehicle costs separately. But then when you got back to the pages that are lined with yellow and red, you've got the personnel costs and benefits and vehicle. And I'm having a hard time reconciling those numbers. They don't. I can't make them all.
Yeah, the personnel costs, I tried to do the best I can with skinning down the dollars on where we're at. We're only going to spend approximately 10% of our overtime, for example, so I brought the number down on that. And as far as the benefits, that's the taxes and fringe the state picks up. And the personnel costs, I just have to make some assumptions on what their salaries are going to be.
So, Mr. McCullough, their salaries are, you know, 82 to 89.5. Then how does that relate back to page 50 where it says the personnel costs are 807, which would make me think it's 160? Oh, biennium. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So I oftentimes confuse people when I'm working on the hour or the annual versus the biennium.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, if I might say,
Mr. Johnson,
Mr. McCullough has put together these last couple of slides just to give you his particular view and recommendation. The Task Force Oversight Council has not said what we would cut, so I just want to be clear on that. In what we did as an Oversight Council was we said this is, we think, an appropriate budget. If whatever the legislature comes back with is something that we'll have to just take into consideration and work with that. And this was just one example of what would cut under the current structure. But it's not, you know, it's not what the Oversight Council has
right.
said we would do with it. So I just want to be clear that it's not that.
Is the $750 that you've talked about the amount that the governor put in his request?
Right.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
All right.
I think it's a continuation of what the existing funding is.
So no increase
without
in
the,
funding.
Without that one-year enhancement that we received last year.
Okay. Senator
That's
Fowler?
My understanding.
Yes, Madam Chair. I heard earlier that you had some kind of a place where you stored some money. And what I'm asking is, do you have authority to carry the any revenue left to?
My understanding, Madam Chair, Senator, is that we have two types of money that will carry over. One is that we have worked with Sue Perkins and Jerry Bovier of the Department of Public Safety, and some of the money that we received last year we're simply not going to be able to expend, and they've found a way to be able to carry that over. I will also say, to some extent, I will say that they've been enormously helpful in working with us and making this task force work well. The other type of money that's carried over, if you will, is money that we have remaining from the U.S. Attorney's restitution that doesn't really have any strings on it. And I forget how much that was. It was a little over 100,000.
117 right now.
I'm advised 117,000. We still have that money in the bank, Senator.
Senator Foley?
Thank you, Chair. I looked at the same thing, 117,000, and just curious to know, it seems to me that even though there's no strings attached by the U.S. Attorney, that if you're looking at those being our dollars, that you need authority to carry it over to the next fiscal year, I would think.
It's been very helpful, Madam Chair, Senator, to have that to help us in transitioning, and we expect that it would continue to be helpful. Just exactly how that's going to be used is something that the Oversight Council will take into consideration when we find out what our final budget is going to be.
So, Senator Foley, are you saying that they have to have specific legislative authority to carry that money over? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And you're asking whether they have that in their statute?
No, Madam Chair, we don't have specific authority to carry that over. We don't have anything that a...
Go ahead.
And that was kind of where I was going. We didn't think that we needed the authority for that, and I've advised... by the department that we don't need the authority with regard to that, which is, for all practical purposes, an outside contribution. It's not state money.
Okay. Senator Moore.
Mr. Johnson, I am looking here, and I'm just looking for some clarification. There's an oversight council that... governs the operation of the task force. How many investigators are on the task force?
How many, pardon?
How many investigators?
Six.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Commander. Just the commander.
How many,
go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator, how many investigators on the task force? How many investigators do we have, John?
Mr. McCullough?
That, other than the commander.
It'd be the commander. In any, there can be designees from, like, the Sheriff's Department that may be investigators, but typically not. They're usually supervisory level.
But, Senator, if I may ask John.
Mr. Johnson.
We have a number of people that are contracted from the cities. Like, we had...
16. Yes.
So we have, like, five investigators, six investigators, however many you showed here.
Commander plus four, I think, is what it was.
Go back to the Oversight Council.
You're talking about it. Madam Chair, Senator, you're talking about investigators on the task force, as I understand it.
Investigators who work as part of the task force.
We have six right now.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, the investigators... I'm a little bit unclear now because when we were listening to the Drug Task Force earlier, the Gang and Drug Task Force earlier, they were talking about part of the salaries being paid by the task force, but the other part is paid by the original jurisdiction with overtime paid by the police department or whatever, so they come in with the task force subsidizing at a fixed portion. Can you talk about how the salaries get paid and what that structure is under the Financial Crimes Task Force?
Mr. Johnson.
John, why don't you take that up and then I'll address it.
On the bottom note of page 50, we have the average grant fund pays approximately 80% of the cost of an officer. We pick up a certain portion of that. And it may vary by city and grant overtime for the investigator. Unlike the task force or the gang and drug task force, their ratio is significantly lower than ours.
And Madam Chair,
Mr. McCullough, what did that sentence mean?
That means that if I understood the gang and drug task force, Madam Chair, if I heard this correctly today, that they receive about 60% reimbursement. Is that not correct?
I think what I heard was that the local jurisdictions paid the salary, and then the gang and drug strike force task force reimbursed the local units about 40% of those salaries.
Okay. And we are different. We're at about 85%.
Yeah.
So you reimburse the local units about 85% of the salaries. Is that right?
That's correct.
Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Wong.
And when I was listening to the gang and drug task force talk about the participants, it sounded to me that and I understand there are two separate entities, okay, so I'm not imputing onto you what they are.
No.
I'm just drawing parallels to try to understand that those officers remain the employees of their home jurisdiction. Are these investigators employees of their jurisdiction, or are they employees of the task force?
Oh, Madam Chair, they're employees of their jurisdiction.
And they're just detailed to the task force? Or
Madam Chair, yes.
Along like that? Okay.
Right. And then they're provided, essentially, the contributing agency is given the money to backfill.
Senator Wong.
So, Madam Chair, then who supervises the officers who are participating in the task force? Is it the Oversight Council, then, that does their reviews and supervises their activities, or the jurisdiction that they came from, who continues to employ them, does the oversight?
Madam Chair, in a sense, the Oversight Council supervises, but the direct supervision is by the commander of the task force. The commander is a statutorily determined position in the task force and leads the task force, and that's Sergeant Johnson.
Well,
yeah, I'm confused. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, they're the employees of their jurisdiction. But the commander supervises them, and we're paying 85% of their salary from the task force. Sounds to me like they're more really employees within the task force. So where do the line of accountability comes in? Who disciplines these? If not that your investigators would do that, but if something were to come up, who disciplines these individuals?
Madam Chair, Senator, the way that I would see it happening, and we've not had a situation to my knowledge where we've had to do this, but my understanding is that we would have to advise the parent agency because they remain an officer of St. Paul or Minneapolis or wherever, and advise that agency that this person needed discipline and provide them the facts that supported that particular type of discipline. The commander directs their activities, and they're for all practical purposes working under the commander just as they would in their parent agency under a captain or a lieutenant or a sergeant. But if we were going to go into a disciplinary mode, we'd have to go back to the parent agency just as, you know, while I can't say that I'm familiar with the gang strike force, I would think they would have to do that too. I don't believe if those are the employees of a different unit that they would be able to be disciplined by someone who's not a part of their particular organization.
Commissioner Campion, would you come up to the table and tell us if this is similar to the way that other task forces that you know about are structured? You
Madam Chair, for the record, Michael Campion, I'm a Commissioner of Public Safety. Your question was,
Is this model similar to other task forces?
Yes.
The short answer is yes, Madam Chair. There are, in the gang world and in the drug world, there are local officers in the city and county level that are assigned to task forces. And as you heard Chief Setter's statement earlier, those drug task forces and gang strike forces are supervised on the local level. And it's important, you heard him stress the importance of some local control. So local sergeants, lieutenants, captains, whatever, generally are in charge of larger units, but it's a model that's similar across the state. And it's a model that's similar across the country. Minnesota is not unique.
Senator Moore?
But Commissioner Camping, what I'm hearing here, though, is that the investigators of the Financial Crimes Task Force are not supervised at the local level, that it actually is an independently operated, autonomous entity that's supervised in terms of what they do by the commander. So, in essence, the officers or the investigators who are sort of on loan from these parent agencies are really no longer working at or with the parent agency. I mean, their time is logged in, basically full-time or logged in at the task force.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct, but that's a similar model that exists in the gang strike forces and the drug task forces. Their time is logged in, and they are supervised. A Minneapolis officer might be supervised by a St. Paul officer of higher rank. So they're both really similar models.
Senator Neville and then Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I was comparing pages 50 and 57, and I guess I got them reconciled. So it looks like you have four investigators, a commander and four investigators. Then you have one additional metro investigator. You contract with three civilians or four, and then you give grants for three more. So then all your personnel shows up on page 55. Does that sound like you've got about 12 people total? And it looks like we're paying them a lot of overtime, $12,000 on average per person. Is that normal? I mean, I don't really know how law enforcement agencies work that in terms of demands for overtime, but on average, we're paying every investigator about $80,000. So if 12 of that was overtime, that's $68,000 base salary. Is that about average, or are these folks with particular expertise that we have to pay them more than a normal investigator?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator, I wish I could say that I was familiar with what overtime is paid in a normal investigative agency. I will say that there's a lot of overtime there, and these people do work a lot of overtime. I've been told by a number of them that they work, frankly, more time than they actually log. There's a legitimate issue out here that's been referred to in a couple of the questions that I think is an issue that the Oversight Council is going to have to take up and actually the Commissioner has raised as a policy issue in some of our discussions in the past, and that is the amount of reimbursement that should be paid as in these types of task forces, whether it's a drug task force, a gang strike force, or a financial crimes task force. We reimburse at a higher level. We pay overtime that I think in the gang strike force that some of the departments may pick up in terms of that cost. And this is just an issue that the Task Force Oversight Council is going to have to work on. But the amount of overtime is attributable, I think, to the hours that you put in on investigating financial crimes, and once you get caught up in it, you can't really log off very well and go on to another one. And it is more detailed and more comprehensive, I think, than a lot of the street crime that I see investigators investigating and logging overtime. And it's easier to break away on some of those than it is on this, unless you're talking about a homicide investigation when you're just go under the wall to get it done. Now, it's a long answer, but as far as I can tell, there was never been a question that the overtime wasn't really necessary. The more legitimate question is, who pays for it?
Mr. Johnson, is it a case of authorizing overtime, or mm-hmm. is it just done and then you pay for it after the fact? And would Mr. Johnston, as commander, authorize or whatever the right word is?
Right.
The overtime?
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. He would be the person who would be authorizing it, saying it's necessary to work these additional hours.
Okay, so then who authorizes Mr. Johnston's overtime? Or as a commander, the person in charge, do you do overtime?
Madam Chair, routinely my timesheet is at the St. Paul Police Department. I fill out that timesheet on the supervision of a commander there. All my time cards that I put out and sign go to that commander that signs off on them, that checks and double checks them. Then they go through my department. As is, each member of the task force does a timesheet with their particular department. Their department tracks their time, the authenticity, and the overtime is sent to their respective department after it's approved.
Madam Chair, if I could just inquire to see if I can clear this too.
Mr. Johnson.
If you have an investigator, Mark, who's on a search warrant or whatever, going into overtime, who authorizes that overtime? Would you, as the commander, authorize it?
Madam Chair, yes, I would.
And if I may follow up.
Go right ahead.
When you decide that you, as commander, are going to work overtime, is that primarily a decision that you make as commander to work that overtime? I assume it is.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It is.
Okay. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then I'll come back
to
that line.
Briefly on the Fair Labor Standards Act provides some guidance in there, and frankly, we can't authorize those folks should be in an overtime status and should be paid for that. And I think thinking clearly of that, I would sense that where the overtime is likely to occur is that the individual investigator takes some action and the supervisor or the manager is not there to give immediate approval. There's some tacit approval that it is approved after the fact. Would that be a more likely scenario?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, it would not. We have basically five or six members on our task force. There's a very finite span of control within the employees. As the commander, I'm keenly involved in everything that transpires there, and no one goes off and satellites and decides, I'm going to go off and work on this, and I'll see you whenever. That's under close supervision.
Senator Foley?
I'm not tracking that. You mean that all of those investigators are working the same hours that you are and can make this, that you can order this person or authorize the overtime?
Commander?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, there are basically five employees that are going to report to me. They report to me every day. I know exactly what they're doing and how long they're going to be doing it for. This is a rather small span of control considering a normal police department, the number of members on a shift or an investigative unit that's normally supervised by a particular individual.
But even in a case where a police department has that, if they're chasing some burglar down the alley or even going to an accident or something, they wouldn't wait to talk to you. They'd just go there or do it.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Well, and the same thing would apply, Madam Chair, when you're talking about the working on the computer or something like that. If you had to do it, you might not call for authorization until after the work is done.
Commander, are people authorized every day for their overtime?
Madam Chair, no, they're not. It is on a case-by-case basis, and it depends on what's going on. And as a rule, we we do not have an infinite amount of overtime. We save it for major things, where we have to have multiple members of our task force there together for reasons of safety and proficiency in what we're doing.
Okay. Commander, is the commander a full-time investigator as well as running the unit?
Madam Chair, in my interim, I am doing both cases and acting as the commander.
And the previous commander?
The previous commander was administrative, did the computer forensic searches, and was involved in search warrants and the ongoing thing. He did not have particular cases assigned to him. Like I stated, he did all of the computer forensics, was involved in the search warrants and the day-to-day operation.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry if you said this already, but do you get cases just by referral from other law enforcement agencies, or can victims call you directly?
Madam Chair, Senator, both. We are contacted daily by law enforcement agencies. We are contacted directly by victims. Oh, okay. And a good part of what we do are things that we find in our investigations. We find many people that are victims before they know they're victims.
Oh, okay.
That's right. A scary sentence. Okay, Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I hate to keep coming back to this, but I still have a question with respect to the salaries. So maybe somebody can clarify for me. I see here under the budget, say a full-time investigator in the metro area, the total budget is 110, and that includes the personnel costs, the benefits, the vehicle. And the 110 is only 85% of what the task force pays for. So the parent agency picks up the rest of the other stuff. Is that the what's in the rest of the stuff? Is that the retirement plan?
Yeah, para, Sue. I think you know that one a little better than I do. There's some benefits that I'm.
Could be $14,000 and $7,200 for the vehicle.
Would you please?
My name is Sue Perkins. I'm a grant manager with the Department of Public Safety. Most of the salaries on the officers in the Financial Crimes Task Force are about $70,000 with about 28% benefits. So an officer in the metro area costs pretty close to $100,000. You add overtime and travel, you can see that we're paying about 85% of the costs.
And
Sandra Moore.
And how is that? I guess I don't know how that's tracked.
We need a blackboard.
Madam Chair, Senator, when we get a grant application for an investigator to be funded, they actually show us the true cost of that investigator. The Financial Crimes Oversight Council has actually put a limit on the amount that can be reimbursed. So we can see what it actually costs. And then we tell them there's a maximum, I think for 21 months it was $164,000. So from that we can tell what the actual cost is versus what the grant pays. And on average, it's different for each department, but if we lump all the investigators together, it's about 85% of the cost of supplying the investigator to the task force.
And so, Madam Chair, what the citizens of the city of St. Paul get when we send Mr. Johnston over to the Financial Crimes Task Force, because the Financial Crimes Task Force basically pays only for 85% of his total cost for the year, we pick up the bill for the rest of his salary. The benefit is that we pay for whatever benefit he creates with what we pick up in the gap. Is that how it works?
Madam Chair, Senator, I will leave that to the Chair of the Advisory Council to answer.
Thank you very much. Mr. Johnston.
Madam Chair, the advantage that you have in St. Paul is that the St. Paul Police Department has made a judgment that if we're going to deal with financial crime that's occurring in St. Paul, that St. Paul is willing to contribute unreimbursed whatever amount of money it is, to be able to effectively deal with organized financial crime. It's something that, initially, as I mentioned, when we were doing it on an informal basis, some departments felt strongly enough about that they were working these multi-jurisdictional cases without any reimbursement, sort of for the good of the order, for the good of the state of Minnesota. But that just couldn't last. I mean, they just couldn't continue to contribute to that degree.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. I have a question. Have you gotten into investigating real estate fraud sort of issues? You know, because it seems like there's always the follow the money aspect of
right.
a lot of the real estate issues and the
yeah. Madam Chair, I'll have John McCullough, who's been working this for some time, address that. We have had to limit our focus to some degree just because there's so much out there. But we certainly have seen some of that, John.
Mr. McCullough.
Madam Chair, we have worked a number of mortgage fraud cases, business scams, investment scams. The FBI comes to us, and the dollar threshold that they get a referral on is not $250,000. It might be $40,000, $60,000, maybe approaching $100,000. They'll ask us to take a look at that case, and we'll compare it to other activity that might be going on and see if we can get some cross-matching going. So we look at the case, and yes, we do work various financial crimes. I can't think of one that hasn't involved a real estate agent, hasn't involved an appraiser, hasn't involved a bank mortgage type person. Businesses that want to sell stock that really isn't registered, we've worked those cases. We've worked healthcare fraud cases and so forth where we've been asked to assist other agencies that may not have the expertise on the following the money. We share between agencies in that respect, not unlike the U.S. Postal Service. They may ask us for our expertise on certain things, and we blend our resources. Commissioner Campion feels very strongly that the training that we're doing creates a multiplier effect. And we're able to work with other agencies that may have a piece of the puzzle but can't finish it off, and that's where the expertise comes in, and that's where we can really assist a local agency such as Farmington or Mankato or Duluth on what the local agency can't get at. In a lot of these cases, you know, no one else wants to touch them. They're ugly. They're paper-intensive. Labor intensive, and we go right back when these cases, if you want to put them together, and you can look at the pictures, they're 5-inch notebooks, and the prosecutors, forgive me Bob, don't have a lot of tolerance for time. Either you get the case in on time or you don't, and sometimes these cases come to us under statute of limitations. We had to drop a case 2 weeks ago. I talked to Bob about it, where the person was scammed for about $70,000, and it's just surfacing to us, but it hit that statute of limitations where we can't take it.
Mm. Do you work much with the Department of Commerce and their investigators?
I'll let Mark.
Commander?
Madam Chair, no, we don't. We work primarily with other law enforcement agencies that come to us, or usually they're victims, many times victims of identity thefts that have found that for some reason they own a home, second mortgage, et cetera, that they did not know about.
Madam Chair, I think this discussion points out something that's worth emphasizing, and that is that you've seen the sophistication of the investigation and how involved this is. I think some of the large departments could probably focus on what's going on in their jurisdiction and understand this and be able to deal with it. St. Paul, Minneapolis. Very few, if any, of the other departments would have the structure that could understand this as well. And Minneapolis and St. Paul, unless they created a multi-jurisdictional task force themselves, would only be able to deal with what's going on in that particular city. That's what's really unique about this, the amount of knowledge that's sophisticated and also the cross-jurisdictional efforts in this undertaking.
Senator Neville?
I don't want to branch too much into this area unless you answer the I guess the correct way, but do you get much into vulnerable adult types of things? What popped up in my mind is that I'm handling a probate now, and the elderly gentleman, before he died, was swindled out of about $200,000, forging withdrawal slips from banks in Minneapolis and St. Paul, taking of vehicles and forging things. And the local police didn't want to get involved because he was consenting to a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Or when the complaint got filed, he'd say, well, I don't want to do anything, even though he was really being taken advantage of. But does that at all come up in your purview? Or
Madam
are you
Chair,
pretty much looking at more organized rings of financial theft?
Madam Chair and Senator, no, I have done a considerable number of vulnerable adults.
Okay.
And many times we find that the caregiver or caregivers are exploiting that vulnerable adult, and they don't know they're being exploited. And when you find out they are, they don't necessarily cooperate with you or want to because they do not have the mental facilities right. to understand that. Therefore, it becomes a very complex investigation. But I could cite you several different examples, the most recent of which two people came to me because their mother was dead. They said the original caregiver did not take care of their mother. Okay, tracing this back, I found out that this was reported. It was reported to through the particular county it was in, but because of what you're alluding to, it fell through the cracks. Nobody really wants to go out and take a hold of these things and do them, because once you do, it's an enormous task. But we have to backtrack and do that. Or another one, I found a quadriplegic amputee. He was victimized, and to make a long story short, he was left in the humble dwelling he was living in with no care because the caregiver had simply left, and he laid in there for, I believe, 3 or 4 days without care. It's not a pleasant picture. But if we do not take these cases and we do not go in personally, physically, and find this, you see what happens to these people. So this is a very big part of what we do, and we have to look out for these victims because the people that are supposed to be looking out for them don't.
And, Chair, I wish I had known about it. I would have referred the case to you maybe, but I mean, this was such a blatant case that it was an 80-year-old who started a relationship with a 38-year-old woman. He was just so desperate for attention. And this woman was involved with others, and it was so blatant that she said to the children of this man, I'm going to take him for everything I can, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. And that's how blatant she was. And looks like she's going to get away with it.
Oh, Lord.
Madam Chair and Senator, that is correct, but we do have the ability to deal with that, and we can make it so people do not get away with those things.
Okay. Maybe Mr. I'll McCullough. Refer to you.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me. Mr. McCullough.
Madam Chair, before we go, if I may just add a few comments at the end here where I think financial fraud is going to lead us down in the next probably 2 to 3 years. I think it's important for all of us to know that we're going to go mobile. No matter what we think today about our laptops being hooked up to cables, we're going to go mobile. We go mobile, you'll be walking into Target and say, I'll put this on my cellular phone, and you'll do a transaction right at the terminal, and you'll be keying in a PIN number, and then that transaction will show up on your phone bill. I can tell you right now, phone utility fraud in Milwaukee has gone through the roof. It hasn't hit us to the degree it has there, but it's coming. Time Warner has told me what has happened with their cable systems. Believe it or not, it's a major issue for the cable companies. It's kind of almost like pirating, but you know the investigation work that local law enforcement can do on these cases is minimal. And we are looking at technology, new processes. I just heard the other day that banks are going to start opening up accounts to immigrants that cannot show documentation for being in the United States. That creates a whole new, without a Social Security number, they're opening accounts. So we're looking at all sorts of new things, such as gift cards. You can now go work for an employer, and they don't pay you with a paycheck anymore. They put it on your debit card. We are talking all sorts of new kinds of fraud here. This world is big. If it's mortgage fraud that needs to be in one particular segment of the market, then it should be there. However, there isn't any really focused group looking at the segments that need to be dealt with. We primarily have been focused on the financial and the retail segment, primarily because I'm there. Secondarily, because there's a lot of elderly fraud that is occurring, that falls right into place. And then you get a murder or a homicide where the wallet's been taken, and guess who gets a call to go try and see if we can track down where the transactions are occurring. So this world of financial fraud is very complex. It's moving. Electronic images are flying between banks. There are secondary providers. We see bust-out scams where you can set yourself up, acquire accounts, charge them, and get to the Cayman Islands as fast as you can to pick up the money. These are the type of cases, you know, if we're not mobile and we're not fast and we're stuck with a bureaucratic process, good luck to us. We're not going to be able to move fast enough. That's why this group is highly mobile, can move fast, can respond to high-level cases without a lot of, well, what's the procedure today?
And, Madam Chair, let me go back to what I said at the beginning. We should, as a state, step back and try to think structurally about how we're going to address these challenges in law enforcement, whether this model that we have here is the right thing with the gang strike force, or is there some other way that we should structure the way that we deal with law enforcement? Again, that hasn't changed from the beginning of time in Minnesota, aside from these couple of things that pop up.
It's all at the local level. Yeah. Senator Moore.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that Mr. Johnson here and I are moving down the same path. I'm struck with the information we've learned about the Financial Crimes Task Force today. I mean, you couple that with the information presented to us by the Drug and Gang Task Force, and you combine that with the information at our hearing the other day where our chiefs of police are saying we need a multi-jurisdictional attempt to get all the guns, not just off of Minneapolis and St. Paul streets, but throughout the state of Minnesota, because there's a network of this stuff being marketed out there, and we need multi-jurisdictional effort in order to address this issue. And I applaud the work that you're doing. I think that this is really, and from the retailers out there who have had an opportunity to work with the Financial Crimes Task Force who have contacted me, it is good work and it is good stuff. And we, I know that you haven't been around for that long, and so wherever there may be hiccups in the system, I am really glad to hear that we, you know, we want to make a concerted effort to make this work, but it also feels like you're not flying a solo flight. I mean, there are lots of other things happening, and I think that, Mr. Johnson, I'll take up your offer to take a look at this, because you're right that it isn't just in the financial crimes area. It isn't just about weapons. It isn't just about drugs and gangs. And we are operating in a very fluid, very fast-paced world where basically just in the last couple of weeks, what we're hearing from law enforcement is we need multi-jurisdictional efforts in order to address these issues. And that's a very good recommendation for us to think about as we move forward. In the meantime, I mean, I think that there's a recognition that the work that you do is needed. You do valuable work, and I think certainly we here at the legislature have recognized that. That's why we've created you and we've funded you, and I think there's an intention here to want to address the hiccups in the process to make sure that we get you up and going and functioning. So,
anyone else? I, too, would like to thank you for the good work that you have done on behalf of the citizens of Minnesota, and it's clear to me that there's a whole lot more out there that will be taking up a lot of your time and effort over the next years. Let us know how we can help. We'll work on some funding issues for you and the Gang and Drug Task Force as well. Members, Friday we have the tour of the Shakopee Women's Prison. We leave the Capitol at 12:30 in the afternoon. And then next Monday, we're going to start hearing bills. We've scheduled three of my bills. Imagine that. the peace officer hiring and overtime grants, the squad car technology grants, and the short-term offender issue. And We may throw a couple more on, or maybe we'll just start with those. Anything else? We are adjourned. Thank you all.